to reach out, use social media, talk to other people, talk to your peers particularly, who are all going through the same thing. You know, we think we're the only one, but I guarantee you everybody in that year that you've graduated is all on the same path.
Welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm David Keir, and this episode we sit down with Dr. Colm Mahoney. Colm is a gentleman. He invited me into his house for this, and this is actually my first live recording. So I hope you enjoy the live recording. I hope it sounds good. One of the reasons we did this live is that Colm likes to record his podcast live. So Colm runs the Communicating Health podcast, and this is something that I really do suggest you check out. It's a podcast orientated around dentistry and healthcare, but communication is the particular topic, and that's something that, as you know, I always talk about. I think it's really important, and so I think you can get a lot from that podcast. Check it out. It's called Communicating Health. Now, Colm is a Dublin-trained dentist. He's practicing in Perth, Western Australia, and after doing a few years in the NHS system in Northern Ireland, he found himself a little bit burnt out. He went travelling, he found Australia, went back to London, did some postgraduate stuff in communication, which we'll get into, and then met an Australian woman, and that brought him back to Perth. He has a real passion for communication, and you'll hear about that in this chat. There's a lot in this chat that's going to help you out. We find out a lot about how Colm ended up where he is. We find out about his early years and the advice he gives people around what he experienced. We find out about his travel and then what led him to doing postgraduate studies in communicating, both interpersonal skills, mediation, and counselling. These are things that are slightly outside of dentistry, but they have really given him a lot of insights for dentistry, and that's why he now does some teaching, does speaking and courses. We talk about things like dispute resolution, something that I think people need to understand why people do make a complaint and how you can get on top of that complaint and help the patient and yourself get through it without having a negative outcome. So there's some specific tips in this that help directly with that, as well as empathy, a definition that I really quite like that he talks about, and how to be empathetic but not to let the empathy affect you. And that's another thing I think really important for new dentists. We then get into some stuff that's specific tips, particularly for students. If you're in your final year or third year, I think that'll help, as well as for new graduate dentists. So I have no doubt everyone who's listening to this is going to enjoy the chat, and I really do think listening to his podcast will help you as well. Straight after the interview today, we have the Prime Head Start segment. Now, the word audit usually sends a shiver down most people's spines, and today we're talking about audits and how to prepare for it and how to be compliant. We're talking with Meg Sharp from Prime Practice, and she spends her days helping people through this kind of thing, whether they've got an audit coming up or a complaint, and she shares her wisdom on how to handle audits and how to get through without stress. Really important topic. Obviously, we all need to be 100% on this, so I hope this is helpful for everyone out there. And thank you to BOQ Specialists for their support for dental students and graduates through the Dental Head Start podcast. And thank you for listening. So every person who's listening to this is giving water to someone in need. And every time you share this with a friend or tag someone into one of our posts, we give dental hygiene to someone who wouldn't otherwise get it. I think that's awesome. I appreciate it. And I look forward to doing that every single month. So all right, enough about that. Let's enjoy the chat with Dr. Colm Mahoney. Being a student is pretty tough. The stresses of exams, patient care, and everyday life is enough without having financial pressures as well. BOQ Specialist recognises this. They offer a student banking package if you're in your last 2 years of dentistry. It's a pretty good package. Actually, I used it myself. They recognise that you don't have much of an income now, but that may change. The student banking package includes a credit card and an overdraft on your account. Payments toward the overdraft aren't required until the 1st of July, the year after you graduate. Now, I'm not recommending you go out and spend this money on anything, but if you need to buy loops or if you need to get through the final year of study, they really do have your back. I know I struggled in the last year financially and it helped me. So thank you, BOQ Specialist, for supporting me in my final year and for supporting the Dental Head Start podcast. Terms and conditions apply. See boqspecialist.com.au for more details. So welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. This episode, I've got Dr. Colm Mahoney with us. How are you today, Colm?
I'm really well, and thank you, David, for having me on the podcast. I really like your work that you've been doing, and I'm very excited to talk to you today.
Well, thank you. It's actually, I should thank you for having me because I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone. Normally I do this remotely over a computer, but today you're sitting across the table. Colm, thank you for having me in your house. Tell me, where are we?
That's no problem at all. We are in Scarborough in Perth, beautiful Perth, about a half a K from the beach.
Yeah.
And we're doing a live recording, which I think, as you said, is a bit out of your comfort zone. And I'm a bit out of my comfort zone sitting here as an interviewee as well. I suppose later on in the conversation, we'll be talking a little bit about empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I interview people, they all say, oh, I'm feeling a bit nervous and I'm a bit uncomfortable about this or that. And now I know what it feels like to be in that position.
It's a totally different situation. Just quickly, I did something with Foresight Live with Omid Azami and I was on the other side, and it's such a strange situation. But thanks again. And I think your story is really important. And I think if anyone hasn't heard your podcast, Communicating Health, they have to listen to it. You talk a lot about communication and empathy and all the stuff we're going to get into today. And I think everyone knows if they listen to this that I think that's very important. And I know you do too. So, Colm, we start at the beginning. Where are you from, Colm?
I'm from a small town called Dundalk in Ireland, which is smack bang right in between Dublin and Belfast, about 80 k's north is Belfast, 80 k's south is Dublin. So Dundalk is on the border between the Republic and Northern Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
So when I grew up, it was the troubles in Northern Ireland, yeah. And my father was a policeman and my mother was a teacher, so my father was involved in all of the stuff that would have been going on in the Troubles. And it was an interesting time to be growing up.
Did that impact on you at all?
No, it was just seen as normal. It was normal life. We didn't think anything of it. And that was just the way it was.
Yeah, okay. It's an interesting thing. I guess something I would find it hard to fully understand, but I guess our normal is whatever we had.
Yes, that's right.
Absolutely. So how did you go through school? How did you get into dentistry?
So I just went through normal school in Ireland. I think is a good thing. Ireland is a relatively classless society, or certainly it was when I was growing up. So everybody went to the local public school, and what that meant really was you were in there with the rich, the poor, and everybody in between.
Mm.
So it was a really good melting pot of people and personalities, and it gave you a really good grounding of dealing with different people and interacting with different people and having to get along with different people and how maybe other people behaved, how other people acted as well. So, when I had to reflect about these questions you might have been asking me, that was first and foremost in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. How did you then get influenced towards dentistry?
Yeah, I think it's a reasonably common story. I liked science.
Yeah.
I liked working with my hands.
Yeah.
I liked people. And dentistry seems to be a very good fit of all three.
Mm.
I wasn't a default dentist. I know a lot of dentists get into it by default because they wanted to do medicine. I specifically wanted to do dentistry.
Mm.
I think another influence on me was the fact that I was one of those very rare kids that when they needed fillings done, I was just super relaxed. And I had a sweet tooth as a kid and I've got a mouthful of fillings. All my sixes and sevens are big MOD fillings, but I'll just lay back in the chair. I found it very relaxing. I actually liked the experience of going to the dentist and having work done. I think I had a very good dentist, which I was lucky about. Perhaps as a teenage boy, he had a very attractive nurse as well. Maybe that played into things as well.
Yeah.
But foolishly, probably in retrospect, I thought this is an easy job because me lying in the chair, I thought that everybody was going to be like me.
Of course.
Just walk in the door, lie down, have a needle put in, lie back, just open your mouth. I just found it relaxing, no problems at all. You get a rude awakening when, in third year in dental school, when you actually saw your first patient and, yes, you realize that's not the case at all. In fact, I was very much the outlier in terms of patients.
Yeah. So did you find that you were quite a good patient, not really recognizing what it might have been? Is that something that led you towards this communication and treating patients with that focus?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if it came specifically from that. No, yeah. I think that came from my later experiences in my first job.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Which we'll definitely get into. Just quickly, with university, you now, you do actually teach in UWA for dentistry and medicine.
Yeah, no, I have done up until last year. So okay. I no longer do that, but I did that for 5 years, teaching communication skills in the postgraduate DMD, which is the dental degree, and the MD, the medical postgrad. Yeah.
That must have been a great experience. Were you actually a good student when you went through uni, or did that come later?
That's a very interesting question, which is something I had to think back, because it's 26 years this year since I graduated, so it's almost a dim and distant memory now. I think I was a reasonably conscientious student in terms of the way I got myself through was I attended most of the lectures. I wasn't particularly studious, as in I always hated study, but I liked, as when we got into third year, fourth year, fifth year, and we started doing the hands-on stuff, I really liked the hands-on stuff. So things like, you know, when we had patient clinics, if I had a fail to attend, I would stay on and assist somebody else or hang around and look at what other people were doing. So that was really, I think, key to me to getting through, enjoying the hands-on stuff, which gave me the motivation, I suppose, to do the study. Yeah. I didn't excel academically going through, but I never failed. I always skirted around that between 50 and 55% and got myself through.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. That's what you need. Do you think that, you liked the hands-on, you did put the effort in with that. Did that help you a lot when you first graduated, or did you find it a shock when you graduated?
No, I think it helped me a lot when I graduated. And one good thing about Dublin Dental School was we got a lot of hands-on experience in most aspects of dentistry, so that when we left dental school, we'd done a lot of extractions, which I think is still a key skill to be confident at extractions. I had done root canals, crowns, all the stuff that you're going to be presented with in routine run-of-the-mill dentistry. Yeah.
Well, tell us about your first job, because I know it was a busy job and you were in the deep end. Tell me about it.
Yeah. When I graduated, I was the first one in our class to actually start working, to pick up a handpiece and get going. So I went up to Northern Ireland, so probably about 2.5-3 hours away from Dublin, but politically in those times, and still now, a different country. So Northern Ireland worked on the National Health Service system, which, as younger listeners may or may not be aware of, because that old system doesn't exist now, but it used to be called Bashing the Nash. New graduates would come out. There was literally a treadmill of patients going through practices. We had 15 minutes to do exam, scale and polish. Fillings were booked in either 15-minute or half-hour blocks. I can't remember root canals, but I'm thinking half-hour, 45 minutes. So essentially half the time that I have now in private practice in Australia to do all my procedures. And this was walking out as a new grad, whereas I'm now 26 years experienced.
Did they treat you as a new graduate the same as anyone else? So you always got 15 minutes, that's what everyone got?
Yeah.
That would have been a very difficult experience at the start.
It was a difficult experience. It was a true and total baptism of fire. Going from the 3-hour clinic, and obviously, you know, third year dentistry, you take 3 hours to do your examination and assessment, and you call the supervisor over 12 different times.
Yes.
To fifth year, when you're pretty much on your own, and you call the supervisor maybe over once when you've finished up your amalgam filling. But it was still a completely different experience. I tell the story, I was talking to my friend Dr. Angus Kelly on a recent podcast, and I was talking about my induction day. So my first day was to turn up at 9 o'clock. There was 2 hours blocked out from 9 to 11 to do induction. So that was meet the staff, look at the computer system, which I'd never seen before, have a fossick around in the drawers and see where everything was, see what the materials were, because obviously all the materials were different to what was in dental school, and just get a feel for the practice, what the flow, where patients come in, sat down, all of that stuff. So walked in at 10 to 9, bright and breezy, ready to go for my induction. And there were three patients sitting there. It was a Monday morning, three emergencies sitting there. And my boss just said, induction's cancelled. Off you go. And I walked into my room and essentially never looked back.
Yeah, wow. That's an experience that, to be honest, I don't wish that on anyone. But I'm sure, you know, you got through. Tell us, with an experience like that, how did you get through? What do you think you did right at that time to help you cope?
What I probably did right was not anything conscious. I think I was young and didn't know any different.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was my first job, and I didn't know that it was going to be any different. And we all knew that if you went to work on the National Health Service, everybody knew. You knew you'd be busy. You knew it was going to be fast appointment times. Yeah. You knew you were just going to walk to the edge of the diving board and your boss was just going to push you off, and you're sink or swim.
Yeah, yeah. I think something that's important to make a point of here is that as a graduate, we have the basic knowledge to be safe as dentists.
Yes.
And we're not great, but we are safe dentists. And so some people, you know, you do get thrown in the deep end. You do know what you're talking about. Trust yourself as well. I think that's something that graduates don't often do.
I think that
you must have trusted yourself.
I think essentially I did trust myself. I had got enough clinical experience. While I wasn't arrogant and didn't think that I knew it all, I was sure that I had enough clinical experience to get me through the basics of being able to do a checkup, a clean, most fillings, most exos, most basic root canals, most crowns. I do agree with you. I think our universities wouldn't let you out, hopefully. Unless you have those basic competences.
Yeah.
Something you asked me early on about the communication side, one thing that became very apparent was that in amongst all those really short appointment times, I did have the clinical skills. However, number one, the most important thing was I didn't have the time to do communication, as in there was no time within that to do communication. There was time to do clinical procedures on a treadmill basis, and that was it. So there was no time to do communication, and there was no time to develop any communication skills either. So even if I did want to communicate with my patients, and I really tried hard, because going back to that thing, I liked people.
Mm-hmm.
I really tried hard to communicate, and my patients, when I left that job after 3 years, my patients liked me. I often scratched my head and thought, why do you like me? We've barely known each other, because I barely had a chance to get to know you. But obviously I did something right within that time period, but it was a real struggle, that communication side. And that became glaringly obvious after a while to me.
How did you notice that?
That's a very good question. How did I notice it? Probably just slowly and gradually. There was no one pivotal light bulb moment. I would have noticed it slowly over time, and probably towards the end of my 3 years there, patients did eventually get to know me, and patients did start saying things like, you know, I'm really comfortable with you now. I really like you. Or they'd start to ask to see me rather than anybody else in the practice.
Yeah.
You know, patients saying things like, you're the first dentist that ever explained X to me, like what I'm doing. Or I used to be terrified until I've come to start seeing you. So when you start hearing those things from patients after a while, you start wondering, well, why are they saying that? What am I doing right here? I suppose, sparked the question. And then ultimately, I suppose, when I left that job and went to work somewhere else where I had more time, and when I saw my peers in those jobs doing the communication stuff really well, then it was like, aha, this is what's missing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We get feedback from our patients, and sometimes, most of the time, we're only going to get the good feedback, to be honest, or very negative.
Yes.
But when it is good feedback, you have to reminisce on that in a way and use that to go forward as well. That's really good to know.
Yeah, and I think something that's very important is when we do get negative feedback, we tend to focus on that a lot.
Yeah.
We need to remember as well the positives as well. When somebody says something nice to you, that tends to go out the window very quickly. But when somebody says something a bit snarky or that contact wasn't quite right, I'm getting food packing, we go home that evening and that's what we're thinking about.
So true.
We don't remember the patient that said, you know, you did a really great job, and I'm referring my friends and my family to you. So yes, I think we need to remember the positives when people tell us nice things.
There's a psychological principle around that, I think, where there's a more emotional response to negative than positive. Yes. I learned that from my poker days, and you'd forget your wins and you'd remember your losses, and it weighs a toll on you even if you're overall positive.
So yes.
And that's an important thing for people to remember.
Yes, it is. And Daniel Kahneman, a book I love, Thinking Fast and Slow, he talks about that as well, the negative, the bias towards the negative weighs more on our mind. Yes.
Very relevant, very relevant. Did you have any mentors early on, or were you just thrown in the deep end and kind of left?
Fairly much clinically thrown in the deep end and left. My boss was doing pretty high-end dentistry, so my role in the practice was to come in and do all the normal stuff, and he did implants. So, and he was very encouraging. He was working on a higher level than me, and he was very encouraging of me to step up and start learning about implants. And to his credit, he would have helped me, and he would have helped me do my first implant if I'd wanted to do that. I simply didn't have the cognitive space to take that on. I was just about flailing, keeping my head above water to do what I was doing and trying to do it well, and tried to do the niceties of as being nice to my patients and all those other things. So I didn't have the capacity to do that. So in terms of mentoring for what I was doing, I didn't have a mentor other than a couple of people who were the year ahead of me who lived in the same area who I was able to sandboard off them, because they'd had an extra year within that treadmill system. So they were able to say, you know, this is normal. Come home, have a bad day. You could get it off your chest a little bit, I think. So no mentor within the practice, but some people to talk to outside the practice, which was probably more important to me at that time.
For sure. It's the psychological support.
Yes.
I think that's really important. If you don't have those people, you know, connect with your people from uni or your local area.
Yeah.
So important. And I've had this, my mentorship in the practice is good, but particularly my support group in the area is good. And in the first year and two, it was very important to me as well.
I think that's really important. And I suppose I was working in a different time, but now with social media, whether that is a benefit or not, I think it probably is for that sort of thing to talk. Even if you're working rural and remote and there's no other dentist there near you, to reach out, use social media, talk to other people, talk to your peers particularly, who are all going through the same thing. You know, we think we're the only one, but I guarantee you everybody in that year that you've graduated is all on the same path, more or less, with very little variation. So talk to people. Yes.
Couldn't agree more. So you spent about 3 years at this practice working very busily, and you made a point saying learning implants, there wasn't quite the cognitive space. I think that's also, you're focusing on foundations. I want to make a point saying that's good and okay for people to do that. And that's something I'm in a similar boat. I think that's critical for us. You then felt a little bit of burnout, perhaps.
Yeah.
What happened towards the end of that? And where did you go on from there?
Yeah, I certainly... burnout was never a word when I was around, and I certainly didn't have the vocabulary to express what I was feeling. My colleague Angus Kelly were both working in practices around the corner, and we became very good friends there. We both hit the wall at about the same time. You used that analogy in our conversation earlier. I suppose burnout, and certainly from my experience and from what I've read about it, is usually not one particular thing. It's usually a cumulative thing. Mm-hmm. After 2 years in that job, I'd handed in my notice. I said I was leaving. My boss made me an offer, as in upped my percentage and really wanted me to stay. So I stayed another year, but certainly by the end of that next year that I stayed, he could have offered me all the money in the world, I wasn't going to stay in that job. I think it was a lot of little things, and it was probably that load of just constantly running on adrenaline and cortisol. The bookings were a bit like the way airlines book passengers onto planes now. So there's a capacity in the cabin for 200 passengers. They book 240 every time, so they overbook. Our practice ran on that overbooking system because patients got, there was a lot of patients getting free dentistry. So mm-hmm. by by default, a lot of those patients kind of took their appointments for granted and showed up when they wanted, didn't show up. Yeah. So often my start in the afternoon would be three patients booked in at the one time, hoping that only two would turn up and then I could work two going in and out of the room, numb one up, send the other one out.
Yes, yes.
Some days three would turn up, some days none would turn up.
Of course.
But I think one of the ways you know you've got burnout is when on those days when nobody turns up, you're actually jumping for joy. You've got a little bit of a circuit breaker. You're not running on cortisol and adrenaline for a half an hour until the next two patients are booked in on the one time slot. So yes, it was a cumulative thing just of that load and that stress, and you can't keep doing that forever.
No, that would be a very challenging thing. I think that feeling of, you know, if someone doesn't turn up, that little jump for joy is not an uncommon feeling.
No.
And it's something, it's a good little circuit breaker, a little check for yourself to see how you're feeling. You went traveling after that.
Yeah.
Tell me about your travels.
Well, first of all, I think the going traveling thing, first of all, was a gift for me, and I didn't realize what a gift it was going to be.
Mm.
Again, I didn't consciously go traveling to ease myself back into dentistry or to specifically take a break. I wasn't really emotionally aware enough of what was going on. But taking some time out and traveling was the best thing that ever happened. So when I did set off traveling, I put a backpack on. I'd never been to Asia before, so headed off to a short trip to South Africa and then went traveling to Asia. It turned out to be the best thing ever in terms of just being able to get myself away, clear my head. I genuinely thought there was a good chance when I went away that I would never go back to dentistry again. So I was looking on the horizon for other things to do at that point. I never really found anything concrete, but I certainly, until I came to Australia after traveling for 6 months in Asia and I arrived in Australia, ran out of money. And of course, the easiest thing to do is do dentistry if you want to make a good, efficient way of making money. You could work for 3 months with the visa I had.
Hmm.
Things, again, were pretty lax. I wanted to go north. We arrived in Sydney in winter, so I headed up to Brisbane. I walked into the Department of whatever health it was then and said, "Have you got any jobs?" The lady behind the counter said, "Yeah, there's a job up in Cairns Base Hospital." I said, "Right, I'll take it." She said, "When can you be there?" I said, "I'll be there in 2 weeks. I want to go to Fraser Island Early Beach or whatever on the way up." She said, "Done. They'll be expecting you in 2 weeks' time." I walked into Cairns Base Hospital that Monday morning. Nobody asked me for any ID. Nobody wanted to see my papers. I traveled all through Asia with my favorite Luxator in my bag, the one, because I knew that if I did have a dental job, that was the
thing. That you needed that. Yeah.
That I knew I'd need that, and that's the Luxator that can get any tooth out for me. So I did travel with my Luxator, turned up with my Luxator in my hand in a steri patch.
I was going to say, you might look a little bit like a crazy person. Yes. Do you still have the Luxator?
I still have the Luxator.
It must be a lucky Luxator.
It is my lucky Luxator.
So with the trip, you know, obviously you run out of money, you start working. Luckily, you've got a dental degree, so you can earn some good money. What did you learn from the trip apart from that?
Learn from travel?
Yeah.
Good question. Just seeing the world. Ireland was a very homogenous society.
Mm.
And just seeing different cultures, different people, the way people live. India was a serious culture shock. It's very, very confronting.
Yeah, yeah.
It confronts you in all senses. The minute you walk out of the airport, the smell, the heat, the sounds, it's overwhelming. And we actually left India pretty quickly because it was just too overwhelming to go from Ireland to India without much to break you in between. And we went to Nepal, Thailand. Yeah, just not in terms of learning. It was more in terms of having the time out, the time to clear my head and put things in perspective, leave what I'd done behind And the further I left it, the further it dimmed in the rearview mirror in terms of those stressful experiences.
Yeah, definitely. I think travel is a really important thing personally. I traveled between my undergraduate and postgraduate degree, and it was similar in a way. I was a little burnt out, without the right word, and it put me back on the right path. So
yeah.
I think it's something that you can't really articulate easily, but it's
no.
Life experience, let's leave it at that, and
yeah.
It gives you perspective.
It does.
So you then obviously got a perspective of how Australian dentistry was,
yeah.
Which was perhaps a little bit different to what you had experienced in the NHS.
Yes, it was. There was much more of an emphasis on taking time and taking that time to do really good quality work. So I was lucky in terms of where I ended up in Cairns Base Hospital. A couple of the senior clinician there had really high standards. He was happy to check impressions and do all those things. So I effectively had my first mentor there, Adrian. I can't remember his surname, but I know he was a really good guy. He wasn't that much older than me, maybe a couple of years more qualified than me, but he kind of put me back on the right path of just that emphasis on taking your time, and as much time as it takes to get the job right is what's key. I kind of always knew that, but that's very hard within the constraints of the NHS. So that was probably part of the battle or the stresses of when working on the NHS, trying to do the job right and be ethical within very narrow time frames. There's always a conflict there somewhere.
Would you call that an ethical dilemma of the speed you have to work at compared to the quality? What advice do you have to someone who might be in that situation now?
I'd say there's very few times when you're in a situation like that now. That was quite a unique set of circumstances, that old NHS system, which doesn't really so much exist now. And I think within Australia, there'd be very few circumstances where you'd be thrown into that situation.
Yeah,
so my only advice would be, don't get yourself into a situation like that.
Yeah. And I've heard people say it in a similar way.
Yeah.
That essentially, if it's not working in that regard, get out. A hard thing, but something that's, you know, keep in mind if you're in that situation.
Yeah, I think listen to your gut on that one. If you, if your gut is telling you it's not right or there's something not right here, and because you may not be that experienced and you may not have seen other practices and how other people work, I think listening to your gut is quite important on that.
Yeah, that's really good advice. How did you end up in WA and why did you not transfer out of dentistry, do you think?
I ended up in WA via London, private practice in London for about eight years.
Yes, okay.
When I came back from traveling again, needed to earn some money.
Yep.
My partner at the time, she was studying in Cambridge and then she got a job in London. So we lived in London. I worked in private practice for about 8 years. We split up and I continued working there. She was Australian and then I met another Australian because London's full of Australians.
Yes.
So the next partner is my current wife. We met and I continued working there. She lived in Perth. She didn't have to twist my arm too hard. One visit to Perth, which I hadn't been to before, it was like she wanted to go back home. I was, all good with that.
You're on the same page pretty quickly.
Very quickly. I was probably more keen to move to Perth than she was. So.
That's good. It's a beautiful place. It certainly is.
It is.
Now in Perth, you work as an associate.
I work as an associate.
Tell me, why do you choose to be an associate instead of perhaps going and owning your own practice or something else?
Yeah, and as I said to you, 26 years experience now, I'm still an associate. I had a chance to really contemplate that question about 3 years ago when the practice I'm currently in and have been in for 12 years now, I'd been there for 9 years, came up for sale. So that the previous owner, who actually still works there, put it up for sale and gave me first look at it. She said she would, and she was very honest about that and gave me the look at it. And so I really looked at that hard. I looked at the financials. I looked at the staff, the setup, and the fact that I had been embedded there for 9 years. There were a lot of pluses in how it could have worked very well for me. Again, I suppose my head was telling me there were lots of positives, and there are lots of positives to being a practice owner. I was projecting now, I'm nearly 50, I was projecting 10, 15 years ahead, and I was thinking I can perhaps retire a little bit earlier than I would otherwise have if I make a good go of this and maybe sell it on in 10 years' time.
Mm.
that was certainly weighing on my mind. And it would have been easy for me to take over there because the patient base knew me. I wasn't coming in cold.
Mm. Yeah, you already owned the goodwill in a way.
Yeah.
You were part of the goodwill.
I was part of the goodwill. I didn't own it, but I had built up a significant goodwill in the practice at that stage.
Mm.
However, back to that listen to your heart or listen to your gut, whichever metaphor you want to use, my gut was telling me I didn't want to do it. And I didn't in the end. I passed on it probably because I thought and thought a lot about it. It's essentially a lifestyle choice that I wanted to make. I didn't want to be beholden to the practice morning, noon and night. I didn't want to have to deal with the staff issues, the materials, the things breaking down, all those things that happen just on an ongoing basis. As I said, there would have been a financial side, there would have been a control side as well. I think a lot of people own practices or buy practices to have control of their own destiny.
Certainly.
And I'm very aware that as an associate, you're always in a precarious situation where the boss could walk in one day and say, we don't need you here anymore and not have to give you any reason. I'm an independent contractor. It just could be termination. They might want to get a mate in.
Mm.
They might want to sell it and the person who's buying it wants to bring their own. It could be any myriad of reasons. So I realized I was relinquishing control of my own destiny, which I had the chance to take hold of there. But the lifestyle choice just outweighed that and outweighed it significantly. And on reflection, it was a very pivotal moment for me. It's the best decision I've ever made in my life.
I was going to ask, was that the right decision? And
it wasn't just the right decision. As I said, I'll put it in terms of other than proposing to my wife or any of those other major momentous things, it was the best decision I made in my life.
I think it's really important for people to hear that kind of story because often we obviously graduate with rarely going straight into ownership, but a lot of people have the goal of ownership again without really knowing what they're getting into and what the lifestyle change may be. Of course, the earning potential is perhaps higher. There's higher risk, though. And, of course, there's certainly higher commitment to time.
Yes.
Initially, at least. And, many people do it amazingly and do a very good job of it. But it is a choice you can make to stay as an associate and to succeed.
I think there is a certain, I would nearly call it a peer pressure among dentistry that you need to, that's just part of the progression. Yeah, you go out, you earn your spurs, you work for a few years, and then you either specialize or take a buy a practice or start one yourself.
Mm.
I think it's important to say that I've done it successfully for 26 years as an associate. However, the caveat to that, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, is maybe how to make being an associate work. Mm. And I think there are some mindsets you need to do to make being an associate work. I think that there's some things you need to consider and also probably some personality traits as well. The first thing is I think a lot of practice owners they want to be the master of their own destiny, the king of the hill, they're that sort of person. They're also very driven in certain ways. And as I said, being an owner of a practice, it might not be, money might not be a driver. It might be a control, a power, whatever. And I'm not saying any of those things are wrong. I'm just saying that's the way it is. And I think you need to have that drive within you to own a practice to really make it work. If you go into owning a practice half-heartedly, I think that's where you can really get burned.
Yeah, because there are significant risks, there's no doubt about that. And I think people have to recognise and be a bit introspective and understand their own personalities enough to go into that with the right frame of mind. Tell us a bit about what you were going to say there with associates. How do you be a good associate?
Yeah, I think, first of all, you go into it with good ethics so that wanting to spend time with your patients, listen to them, be kind, empathy, all those things that we do anyway, hopefully. I think treat the patients, even though they're not yours, then you're not building up goodwill for yourself. But I think I've always worked at, I'm building up my own practice within the practice. I'm building up my own goodwill. Yeah. Hopefully I'm building up a loyal core group of patients that like seeing me and will ring up and ask to see me. Mm. I know in legal terms they're not my patients in terms of goodwill, but I still see those patients as my patients and I still see it as building up goodwill. Mm. I realize I'm building up financial goodwill for somebody else. That doesn't bother me at all.
They're both really good points. I think for some people, they may not recognize that the goodwill, you don't actually own it. You have, if you leave, you have no right to any of the details of the patients, yeah, et cetera. But at the same time, you know, they are your patients you treat. You know, you don't own the goodwill, but you serve those people and they come back to you. And the longer you're in a practice, the more you see that, you see the fruits of that grow.
I agree. And I think if you do that well, you make yourself more and more indispensable in the practice. Yeah. So if the reception staff and the practice manager and the boss hear the patients are ringing up and only want to see you, yeah, and say the boss has a hour cancellation and one of my patients rings up and said they want to be seen and the boss says, well, fit them in with me, and the reception says, no, they only want to see Colm, that a smart boss will register for that, sure, and say he's doing something right. So if you run your own practice within a practice like you're a practice owner, so as I said, treat the patients like your own and be ethical. Obviously, as I said, I'll emphasize again, financially you don't own that goodwill, mm-hmm, but if you emotionally own that goodwill, I think that's a really good mindset to go into. And I would go so far as, you know, things like if problems arise, sorting them out quickly, fitting those patients in at lunchtime, ringing them in the evening if you do difficult extraction, even though, as I said, they're not your patients in one sense, they're your patients in another sense, and treat them as your patients.
Tell me about your post-op calls that you might do. Do you do them?
I do them, yeah.
What's your protocol there? So what I mean by post-op call, for anyone listening, you've done a difficult extraction, you've done whatever it may be. You know it was difficult for the patient. You call them to see how they're going. Not everyone does that. In fact, not many do.
Yeah, the post-op call or the TLC call.
TLC, that's it.
Yeah, I spoke to one of my other guests, Sharon Zaks, about this, and I admitted to her it's probably something I don't do enough of. I do, but I don't do enough of it. And I'd say most of us probably can put our hands up on that. She really talked about the importance of that. Mm. I think one thing that always holds us back from doing that TLC call is not a time thing. Mm. It's that the patient's going to say, oh, that really hurt, or oh, I wish I'd never had that done, or you know, I'm really struggling, I'm in a lot of pain, etc., etc. In fact, 99.9% of my experience with TLC calls is quite the opposite. Patients are so grateful, mm-hmm, so appreciative, and it's a huge goodwill builder for you as a dentist, even as an associate or a practice owner. It's hugely important, and I would thoroughly recommend the goodwill call as a thing to do.
That's really good advice. And I was putting up my hand before to say I'm someone who should do it a bit more than I do, but it is something I do at times. I've even, when I get referrals, sometimes I write a handwritten thank you or something like that, or at least a call. I think it makes a huge difference and these patients don't expect it. So it's a goodwill builder, but it's just basics of caring for someone.
Yeah, and it's also personal. You're ringing them. Yeah. There was one I did last week, a tooth that came out and it wouldn't stop bleeding for unknown reasons, and I packed the gel packs in, wouldn't stop bleeding, two stitches in, barely stopped bleeding by the time he left. So I was quite concerned about him, and I said I'd ring him, but I rang him in the evening and didn't get through to him, but I left a voice message with him. So the next day when I come into work, I open up my email and there's an email from him, really, you know, thank you for ringing, sorry I didn't take your call, really appreciate you ringing, everything's fine, thanks again, John. And patients really really value that. I think it's a hugely important thing to do.
Just before we change the topic, can I ask one more thing? I've seen people do this a little too much, and what I mean by that is they do the post-op calls and ask, is it sore? The patient says, yes, it is a little sore, because, of course, we're doing surgery on a patient. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of deal with that? Is that just experience understanding that? Or?
Yeah, probably, first of all, I will have told them when they're leaving the room, so that if they're sore, it's not such a surprise that evening. I think that's the first thing is
Very good.
Is planting that seed that they know they're going to be sore.
Yeah.
So that if they are sore, they know they're going to be sore. So I think the call is just the icing on the cake.
Good.
So they know they're going to be sore already.
That's really good. I think that that's important part to think about and to preempt that for patients.
Yeah, and that's the thing that comes with experience, I think. You see, and usually from having made mistakes in the past.
Yes, certainly.
So you learn from the two times that you didn't warn the patient. The third time, you do warn the patient.
That's right. Nothing teaches us more than a mistake of our own.
Adding a little bit more value to, to the practice, I would say see kids if you're in suburban practice. So be flexible, be adaptable.
Mm.
See kids are a huge practice builder.
Yep.
And parents often send the kids in as the guinea pig, first of all. I would often have thought it was the other way around, but it's actually not.
That's very true, yeah.
Parents often send the kids in and you do an exam on the kid, and the kid walks out with a smile on the face and a sticker on the T-shirt, and you can be guaranteed within a week or two those parents will be there. So, seeing kids really important. Again, having that ethos of almost being the practice owner. So anything you can do to help run the practice. So I would think a lot of new grads coming out will have a lot of IT skills, social media skills.
Mm-hmm.
So putting your hand up and saying if the practice is starting a blog, or do you think we should start a blog? Maybe just giving a little bit of extra value to the practice. You're not getting paid for it, but in these precarious times when jobs are scarce, and if you find yourself in a good practice, anything you can do to add value to yourself as an entity within the practice, I think is very smart. And if you like the practice, you can either stay as an associate or eventually maybe buy in. Things that I used to do was I'd done a lot of other studies, so communication skills, conflict resolution skills, counseling skills, lots of other things. So I always sit in on practice meetings, especially disciplinary meetings, as the impartial third party.
Mm.
And I think that's been a very useful experience. And I think the practice owners have always valued that, especially in those disciplinary, more conflict and conversations, to have somebody impartial sitting there to kind of dissect things apart and help them get to a resolution is really important. Even other simple things like when a guy comes in to repair your chair or fix something that's always going wrong, stand and watch what he's doing so that when the thing goes wrong the next time, you can lift the chair up, pull the seat off and screw a few things together or get a few washers out and replace the washer. I think anything you can do to add value to yourself being in that practice, I think is key.
That's all really good. I love that last one, actually. Watch the tech, because depending on where you are, if you're regional, it might take days for the tech to come out. So you could be out of action. But also, it might save the practice a couple hundred bucks
for
call out fee. Yeah. And, you might not be saving yourself that money, but it works for you in the end.
Yes.
And you made a few good points about practice builder things.
Yeah.
And most of us as graduates come out, often we come out with a list that's not full. We might have quite a bit of space in our list. So all these things that are good as an associate to keep your job actually help you directly. So really great advice. I like all of that. And I think it's all very relevant.
And one other thing, be flexible and adaptable. So every new place you go, there's going to be new staff, new systems, new IT, new materials, new ways of doing things. Be flexible, because you're not going to have things the way they were in dental school or the way they were in the good practice you worked in last time. All the new stuff works in that practice. Just embrace it and go with it, and you'll actually learn how to use new materials and use things and new IT systems. So take it as an opportunity, be flexible and go with it.
Don't start a job and ask for a $15,000 piece of equipment.
Exactly.
Love it. Any other points on that?
No.
That's fantastic. I think that's all really, really useful. Let's talk about dentistry itself. It's pretty tough. I'm 3 years out. It can be stressful at times, but I've heard you say it does get a little bit easier. How is it 26 years out?
Yeah, it gets easier in a few different ways, I think.
Yeah.
On a very fundamental level, time management is a key thing that you get good at in dentistry. And there was a study a few years ago in the ADJ, Johns said time and scheduling pressures are the biggest stressors for dentistry. And I think, again, I'll relate it back to my days in my first job when we had 15 minutes to do exam S&P. Time, that was a huge stressor. So when I saw that study, it was like, again,
it all made sense.
Yeah. But, so you get much better at managing time. So managing appointment times, when somebody comes in and they need something, you can tell them exactly how much they'll need going out. And time... I go in early in the morning and I look at my book and I'll extend a little bit. So just tweak my book because I know patients, and to make your day run smoothly and run on time is not only good for you, but again, it's another practice builder. If you run on time, patients comment on it. They love being called on time because they're so unused to being called in on time with doctors, dentists.
Particularly doctors, but dentists as well. It's a really good one. And your staff. Your staff get stressed as well.
Yes, that's a good point, which I hadn't got in there. But yes, that's probably from your experience as well.
Yeah, I've been on both ends of that. You know, I've caused it and suffered it as well.
So you develop a sort of sixth sense of timing. You also develop a sixth sense, I think, of your limits as well over time with experience. So that root canal that you think, I didn't find that fourth canal, or that fourth canal is difficult, you know when to keep going and you get a better sense of when to refer. That extraction, and you'll hold up the x-ray if it's old school, or you look at it on the screen and you go, I'll have a go at that, or no, I'm going to refer. You just get this learned often from hard experience of that. Yeah. What's the most horrible sound in dentistry? The sound of a tooth cracking. Yeah.
We all know the feeling.
Yes. You also get a better handle on patients and patient behaviors. And I think that really is a big game changer as well. So again, referring back to those first 3 years when I had no cognitive space and no time, no physical time to actually work on that communication side. Now I do, and the time you can spend getting to know patients but also just reading patients much better with experience. And there's no shortcut to that other than just doing it.
Yeah, I think all of those, they're so important things, but really it's hard to get your advice on how to improve them, because they all sound like things that come with experience.
They do come with experience. I think we'll get on to this a little bit later. There are skills you can learn and practice those well. But,
certainly.
But it's a combination of both, of learning and experience.
Yeah, and particularly I guess you're referring a lot to the understanding patients and communication and empathy. And
that.
So let's get into that. Now, Colm, you actually have an interesting history in this kind of thing. You obviously, you're a dentist, but you've done a lot of postgraduate training in other areas.
Yeah.
You did counselling skills in 2002, a one-year certificate. 2004, you did a postgrad certificate in interpersonal communication skills.
Yeah.
In 2005, you did a postgrad certificate in conflict resolution and mediation.
Yes.
How did you get into doing that?
Long story short is my father died young in 2001.
Yeah.
And dealing with a lot of the fallout of that for me and my family, I did the counselling skills course just to sort of try and help myself and also help me interact with my family. Obviously, my mother and all the grief and all of that.
Yeah.
The counselling skills course was just a huge eye-opener. Counselling is all about listening. Yeah. It's all about helping patients, being a mirror to help. It's not like psychotherapy where you're more interventive. Counselling is more being the mirror and you're helping patients say things and reflect it back so they actually work the stuff out for themselves.
Yeah.
So very, very big on listening, empathy, understanding, the key skills, being genuine. And all those skills that I learned in that just went straight into dentistry. So all just so relevant. So by the end of that course, I could sit and do a 50-minute session with somebody. So they talk about the 50-minute hour. Listening is very, very difficult. Proper active listening, where you're engaging with the patient and you're demonstrating to the patient or the client in counseling that you are listening to them, is very, very hard on your brain, hard on the cognitive load again. So by the time I built up a lot of practice in that, that was really useful for me going into practice.
What transferred directly, would you say? from those early years of counselling?
Listening skills?
Basically,
yeah. Actually, I'll take it a step before that. Actually, just hearing about empathy and listening. Actually, just hearing that empathy is a concept. Empathy is a word that's only been around for the last 10 years or so. You got to think this is back early 2000s. It wasn't the buzzword that it is now. So actually hearing about and understanding what empathy is, because I do advocate very strongly that empathy is a tool and a skill. It's not a state of being. You learn empathy and you practice empathy. You don't be empathic. So learning about empathy, what it is and how to do it, I think it was a really big game changer for me, both professionally and personally, I have to say.
Yeah, it sounds pivotal, I guess. Yes. It would have opened your eyes a lot to things you perhaps didn't see before. And that's great that you're now teaching and helping dentists do that exact thing.
Yeah.
Because it's easy for us to miss the difficulty for patients as they come in and see us.
Yeah.
You went through to do other communication training.
So this opened the world up of communication. So I did, in the University of London, I did postgrad certificate in communication skills, which was a great year. Again, this was all part-time while practicing.
Yeah.
And in the counselling skills course, one of the teachers was a mediator. I'd never heard of mediation either. So he was in mediation is dispute resolution, where you get people around the table and you thrash out the conflict.
Yeah.
In not, that's basically it in so many words.
Yeah.
So
this is outside of dentistry.
So this is initially was outside of dentistry. So he had a little company that was in northeast London, in pretty rough areas of London. They accepted referrals from the local councils of neighbour disputes that the local councils had tried to resolve and couldn't resolve. So this was the
fun stuff.
This is the dumping ground of the most intractable neighbour disputes, and we were tasked to deal with these by process of mediation. Started working with him and his company as well, part-time, as a professional mediator, as well as being a dentist. So part of that for me was, I was already doing the communication skills course at this time, and then the conflict resolution skills was me going and doing more academic study in this area of mediation, because it really interested me.
I was going to say, obviously it interested you. You sounds like you enjoyed it.
I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Do you think that having that other interest that crosses over with dentistry, but it's another interest, do you think that helped you with your dentistry or with your happiness in life?
Both.
Yeah.
Yes. A total 100%. Yeah. So number one was dentistry, putting those communication skills back into dentistry. Again, a little bit later on, after the counselling, with the mediation and the conflict resolution, understanding conflict was really important, and it's really important in dentistry as well. Yeah. A lot of people are afraid of conflict, and conflict is a negative word. The teaching and the theory on these communication skills courses, and then working as a mediator, was how to use conflict as an opportunity to get these people to move forward. So they were stuck often in years of dispute. So how to reframe the conflict for them and show them a path how they could move forward together as neighbours. So the reframing of conflict was really pivotal for me in dentistry, and I've applied that a lot in dentistry. When I receive a complaint, I now don't put the shield up and get all defensive. I sit there and I listen to it.
Yeah.
And I don't respond with a defensive answer. Yeah. I thank the patient and thank them for bringing this to me, and I reflect on it and say, I'd hear what you're saying, and I'll listen to them, and I will maybe respond. I would be assertive if it's something that they're blatantly wrong about. I'll point that out to them, such as we all know in dentistry that the bloke who comes in and said that filling you did 2 months ago has fallen out, and they point to the lower right. And they haven't been into you for 2 years, number one. And the last filling you did was on the upper left.
Oh, yeah.
We all know those people. So that's a different story. You know, you're straight in there. No, this is what it is. You're not practicing your namby-pamby listening skills here.
No.
But more something where there is where you can see that the patient has incurred extra cost or painful outcome as a result of some intervention you've done.
Mm.
Sit back and actually try and understand the patient's perspective. And that's very powerful, a very powerful way of dealing with conflict and a very powerful way of keeping that patient loyal to you, and also a very powerful way of preventing that complaint from escalating.
Mm. That's when you say reframing conflict, is that what you mean by sitting down and listening, or is there a bit more to that?
Well, the number one, the reframe is conflict as an opportunity, as an opportunity.
Reframing your own mindset.
Reframing my mindset. Yeah. That conflict is not a threat.
Yeah.
Conflict is an opportunity for learning and growth.
Constructive criticism.
Yes.
That's actually fantastic. I really like that. And I like the way thinking about that. There are ways we can look at things and think about things that change it entirely. And if you look at it as a positive like that, you know, you can get something out of it. And if you deal with it in the way you've just discussed, which is listening and working with the patient, it may just save yourself a lot of grief.
it certainly, I think that's very true. And certainly from that work in neighbour disputes, then when I moved back to Perth, I started working in part-time practice in the practice I'm still in. But I worked with an organisation which is now called HADSCO, which is, I think every state has one, a local government department that receives health complaints from consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So we dealt with those by a form of mediation. So I did that for two and a half years here in Perth until our first child was born.
Yeah, got a bit busy.
Got a bit busy and took some time off doing that to let my wife go back to work and share. And so, So I left that by the wayside, but that was a job that was, again, extremely rewarding.
Yeah. And the skills obviously have transitioned straight through into your work and your life.
Yeah. So the skills transition straight through, applicable in dentistry, applicable in those jobs. And again, something big that I learned, in particularly in health disputes, was that patients who are in dispute are most of the time not after money.
Mm.
They're after some form of acknowledgement that something happened, not necessarily an admission of liability, an acknowledgement that something happened. For somebody to sit down with them often and look them in the eye and give them an explanation. So somebody with a degree of authority, either the person involved or somebody very senior, not somebody way external, down the pay grade, external or way down the pay grade. And what they want is an acknowledgement, an explanation, and most of all, some form of reassurance that this will not happen again.
Mm.
And again, that's sometimes a conversation I'll have with my patient. If they say such and such happened, pain after such and such, I'll say, again, thanks for bringing this to my attention, and I'll try and incorporate this into my learning to ensure that it doesn't happen to anyone else again. And I'm being genuine.
Of course.
I'm taking it as a learning opportunity, and I will learn from it. But I'll also vocalize that to the patient, because I think that's often a reason that patients bring a complaint. They're not looking for a refund. They know that what's been done is done, but they want to try and ensure that it won't happen to either them or anyone else again, and you've taken that on board.
That's great, and I think everyone should listen to that, perhaps even again. If you ever get any situations where there's a complaint, either it's mild or a major complaint, make sure you tick those boxes genuinely.
And
you have to obviously mean any of this, but that's so important to understand. So communication's a key part of, you know, your postgraduate studies and then what you went on to teach with UWA for many years. Why communication? How did you get so interested in that, and why do you think it's so important?
The first question first, why did I get so interested? Probably, again, relating back to my first experience of work, knowing what was missing in that job.
Mm.
Communication wasn't taught to us in dental school, so again, we were expected to pick that up by a process of osmosis. So, But I do remember, relating back probably to your student listenership, one thing we used to do was, again, I said when we had a cancellation, we would stay on the floor, or I would certainly try and stay on the floor, and you'd go and maybe hold suction for a colleague, or maybe even better, hold suction for somebody higher up, and you'd see more dentistry being done. But another thing that I always noted when I was doing that, I was not only holding suction and watching what the next thing that I was going to have to learn, watching that being done already, but I was also watching how these more confident clinicians were able to relate to and communicate with their patients. So I think I could see that very early on that it was important. I think now why am I doing it? It's something that just really interests me. I'm passionate about it. So, yeah, and you and I are both doing a lot of work in this area. We're not doing it to make our millions. We're not doing it to make anything out of it.
Yeah, we could work one day and pay more than all.
Yeah. So it's something I'm very interested in, something I'm passionate in. And it so coincides that it's something that is maybe not necessarily emphasized very well in dental undergraduate learning. But I think more importantly, I think when you come out as a newly qualified dentist, most of your mental capacity is going on those clinical skills. And that's understandable.
Yeah.
It's difficult. It's hard. You've got the time frames have been compressed. The learning and the developing of the communication may be set aside for understandable reasons because you're really trying to get the clinical stuff done well.
I often say this, that the universities do a good job in getting us to where they get us, and it's definitely not the whole way, but they do a good job, but there's not much space for it, unfortunately.
No.
But it is actually the most important thing by far afterwards, as long as you're safe.
Yes.
Your patients remember how you made them feel.
Yes.
And that's communication.
Yes.
So what do you see often done poorly by graduates in the communication field?
That's an interesting question. I probably don't see enough graduates. So
students, perhaps?
Students. Yeah. I don't see anything specific, but I see a lot of emphasis in the postgrad world about increasing your case acceptance, about building up your practice, about patient retention, about ethical selling, all those words being used. And I'm not saying there's any problems with those words or those terms or those concepts, but what I'm not seeing is the step before that. So I think to get to those places of building your practice and having increased case acceptance and patient retention and all those things that everybody's striving for, I think you need to really focus on working on some key core skills. First of all, having awareness that those skills exist and that they're important. And secondly, understanding them and knowing what to do and practicing them, because they are like riding a bicycle or learning how to play a piano. Most of us can't do them very well, but by the time we practice and practice and practice and do our 10,000 hours of those sorts of things, we then develop a competence.
Yeah, definitely. So I can't help but ask, what are these skills and how do we learn them and be better at them?
Yeah, I've done a few talks recently, and I suppose a few key skills that in terms of the dental appointment would be making a good first impression. Now, there are a number of ways of physically doing that, by how you greet the patient and all of that sort of thing, and smiling and eye contact and handshake or not handshake, or call the patient by the first name or not, and all those ins and outs, which it's neither here nor there. But having an overall view of the presence you create, patients are judging you long before they actually see you. So things like the advertising of your practice, the practice website, your presence in the community, do you sponsor a netball team or the exterior of your building? Things even like the building, is there easy car parking, is there disabled access, is the waiting room comfortable, is there loud noise, is there calming music? When they walk in, do the staff greet you with a friendly greeting, or is the staff member flicking through Facebook on the phone and just looks up and grunts and goes, points it over there? So there's lots of things happening around you that are causing patients to create an impression of you before they even meet you. So trying to be a little bit aware of all those things, because that's all communication, that's all nonverbal communication. And patients are judging you and making an opinion of you before they even meet you.
As an associate, do you have any advice around those things? Because they're mostly things that are practice run.
Yes. they're things that you've got less control of if you're not a practice owner. However, if you see things like to me, the big no-no is the disinterested staff member, you know, the staff. That's probably number one. Mm. So if you see things like that, I think you're well within your rights to have discussion with your boss. So having your eyes open for things like that, or if you know that there's simple ways, we've got an old building with a big step up, so we've got a ramp to get people up. And if your practice doesn't have things like that and you see a need for ways to help people with wheelchairs in, or things that you see, you still have input. And again, you're providing that value to the practice again by bringing up these things in discussion. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
The second thing is the old listening and active listening. So not just listening, active listening. I don't know if people understand the difference. So active listening is demonstrating to the patient that you're actually listening.
Mm.
So I've got a 9-year-old, almost 10-year-old daughter, and I'm getting them to school this morning and I'm barking out instructions, and she's just sitting there on the floor looking at Pokemon cards. And I don't know whether she's heard me or not,
yeah.
But I've said it again and she turns around and said, yeah, I heard you.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She's listening.
Yeah.
But active listening would be her turning around and saying, and looking me in the eye as I'm speaking and demonstrating to me that she's listening. So yeah. We've got those opportunities to do this well or not so well in dentistry as well, because we sit behind the patient,
mm.
we've got masks on, we've got glasses, or often loops, which is an even bigger barrier.
Yeah.
The patient's lying on their back. A really core basic thing about listening, and particularly active listening, is if you've got something important to say to the patient, you demonstrate using communication skills, so that's verbally and non-verbally, that you're actively listening to them.
Mm.
So I have a mnemonic for the non-verbal, which is snore.
Okay.
Which, so you sit square, so
yep.
The S is sitting square on, so you're not sitting sideways or behind them.
Yep.
Your nods, so little nods, raise your eyebrows when they say something important. So demonstrating by your facial expressions that you're listening. So the square, the nods, the open. So you're not, your body language must be open as well. You're not sitting there with your arms folded and your legs crossed and your shoulders all hunched up and your jaw clenched. You're relaxed, so that goes with the open and the relaxed, and the E is eye contact, so you're making eye contact. And now lots of people ask about eye contact and the ins and outs of that. Is eye contact is a complicated one. You judge from the patient. The patient should be the guide of the eye contact. If the patient's not comfortable with eye contact and looking away, you go by those cues. You don't keep lasering in on eye contact. So, yeah. So, and verbally, things like reflections. I've heard you talk about clarification as well in some of your podcasts. Clarification is a really important thing. I think people think, maybe if I check this, well, are they going to think I'm a dummy or I'm not listening? They actually think the opposite. If you clarify something, they really can see that you're listening, and they get a real, that's really demonstrating that you're listening.
Mm.
Reflecting back meaning, so meanings of things that they say, but more importantly with listening is reflecting back feelings. So they come and say something to you like, you know, the tooth you did yesterday was really sensitive, can't drink water this morning, and I've got it going out for dinner tonight and I want to drink champagne. So you can reflect back the meaning of, you know, you've got a sore tooth, or you could reflect back, come in, you may be speaking to them on the phone, come in, I really want to help you. I can hear from you that, you know, this is really annoying you or upsetting you and you want to have a good dinner tonight, come in, I'm going to help you fix it. Mm-hmm. So there's two different ways of saying it. But if you reflect back the feeling, it really demonstrates in a powerful way to the patient that you're actually not just listening to the words, but you're listening to the feelings behind.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It certainly does. I think that's really important stuff. The emotion behind it is what they're trying to portray.
Yes.
If you can show that you understand that, then you understand what they're saying. I love your analogy with your daughter and active listening versus just listening. And that's another one that's really important. We got a little bit of training on that, actually, in our postgraduate at Sydney. I don't think it was... put into the context of private practice and the environment that we're truly in.
Yes.
I'd make a point. I'd love you to elaborate on this, that everyone does this very differently. And it depends a lot on your own personal personality, the way that you get this across.
Yeah.
Around that, I guess, do you have any advice for certain personalities, or are there certain personality types you can think of that might struggle with this, and advice for them?
No, I think some of the, I agree with you. Everybody's got to be, congruence is another word. You've got to be genuine, and you've got to do all these things in a way that suits your personality. So it's not just,
there's no script,
learning a formula or a script and doing it. And again, that's another concern I have with some of these management style things where, and I know a lot of them are moving away from scripted. So they're more coaching people in the principles, and then people work on their own script, which is, I think, much more valuable. I think when you go into scripting things, everybody's different and different scripts work for different people.
Yeah.
Your question, are there different ways? I think some of those key principles, like the snore, I think, no, that's quite universal, I think. Just get used to it.
Yeah.
You know, just do it, because it's kind of a universal thing. Practice. Mm. Again, my colleague Angus Kelly, who lectures in communication over in the UK, he said, use technology now.
Mm.
Get out a phone, set it up, and film yourself doing a practice with a friend or a colleague, and get all your little tics and all your little foibles and all your anxieties. If you are a very introverted or shy person and you find it uncomfortable to sit square on to somebody and look them in the eye, practice it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
because I think it's something you have to do, because you have to demonstrate to the patient that you're listening to them. Otherwise, it's like, as you said, it's like my daughter and me this morning. I don't know if she's listening if she hasn't demonstrated to me in some way that she is actively listening.
Yeah, that stuff's absolutely crucial and great advice. Did you have anything else to say around that topic?
Yes, the big one is empathy.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And there's a few things. There's a lot of talk about empathy at the moment. First of all, giving a definition of empathy, and because there's many definitions. The definition I work off for empathy is, it's metaphorically walking in the other person's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do three things. One is to understand the way they're thinking, so the cognitive part. The second is to understand the way they're feeling, which is the affective part. And the third, and probably the most important thing, is to use this understanding to guide your actions.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of talk about empathy, and is empathy being overdone, and is empathy the cause of burnout, and I fully engaged with that conversation. And first of all, I was thinking, no, empathy is great.
Yeah.
But obviously there's more nuance to it than that.
Mm.
Empathy, if you've got too much empathy, that's not helpful. And really, if you're in a position where you're paralyzed by feeling the person's pain or feeling the person's anguish too much, you're not in a position to do the third part of that definition. That's why that definition is really important. You become paralyzed. You focus back in on yourself, and you become protective of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's that burnout, or if it's cumulative enough, it becomes burnout, or it can be just in individual situations.
Mm.
So empathy must be, you must have these checks and balances between the thinking part and the feeling part.
Yeah.
If you find yourself, and again, this is practice, if you find yourself getting a little bit overwhelmed by the emotion of something that somebody's saying, you recognize that and you rein that back in and maybe focus back on what they're saying. Because you don't want to be in a position where you can't take action. And you're no good to the other person if you're in a position where you can't take action.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to a podcast today, and the guy was talking about going to see a psychiatrist, and he was talking about empathy, and he was saying, there's no good me going into a psychiatrist and talking about my anxiety, and the psychiatrist sitting there and getting all wound up with my anxiety and bursting into tears, and me having to hand over the tissues for them to wipe their eyes. They need empathy, but the empathy is in a detached way. So I think that's a really key thing, because people are getting this confused that empathy is a state of being where you're locked in and you're feeling all the patient's pain and anguish. That's not empathy.
No.
That's the road to burnout. So you need to catch yourself if that's going on. You're no good to yourself, and you're no good to your patient if you're buying in too much to that.
It's definitely something we do early on, I think. We take on our patients' burdens. And in the end, the patient brings us their problems to help them with their problems, not our problems.
Yes.
We don't own those problems with the patient.
Yes, the word own is a really important word. Yeah, so ensuring that the patient keeps ownership of the problem. Yeah. You're there to help them with that. And again, I suppose I learned that through counselling as well. They're very big on that. Is not taking on the problems. It's you're the mirror to reflect back. The patient or the client owns the problems, and it applies in dentistry as well.
I was going to say that perhaps that metaphor is a useful one, the mirror for that, and to help them with their problems, but not let it get through that mirror.
Yes.
That's great.
And
did you have something to say there?
And I've got one more thing to say about empathy is that people think empathy is the golden rule, and the golden rule well, I'm from a Judeo-Christian background. The golden rule is treat others as you want to be treated yourself.
Yeah.
And George Bernard Shaw had a witty reply to that. It was, do not treat others as you would want to be treated yourself, because they might have different tastes. So it's more, and we think, I've heard people talk about, if in terms of treatment planning, we're not doing good dentistry unless we're doing the optimal treatment. Now, I want to put the question out, who's optimal are we talking about? Are we talking about the dentist's optimal, where, it's going to be a full gold crown on a lower seven, because that's the most conservative, on a broken down lower seven, it's the most conservative, it's the best long lasting? Are we talking about the patient optimal? Are we talking about a collaborative relationship between the dentist and the patient, and the dentist empathizing and understanding the patient to work out the optimal for both?
Yeah.
So I hear this thing about good dentistry is not good unless it's the optimal treatment. We want to make sure that we're actually not practicing the golden rule, we're practicing the platinum rule, which is treat others as they would like to be treated.
For sure.
So the analogy I've used and I've heard said is like buying a birthday present for somebody. If I apply the golden rule to my wife, I'll buy my wife a case of craft beer and a car magazine subscription.
Yeah.
So I need to take myself out of myself and put myself in my wife's shoes and see what would she like, and I've got to go to the jewellery shop or whatever it might be and get really out of my comfort zone and start looking at stuff like that. And I think that analogy applies in dentistry as well. The optimal is not the optimal for the dentist. And it's finding out it's a dance between the dentist and the patient and working out what is the optimal for both.
Yeah, as long as the patient understands the options they have in front of them, they make the decision, and it shouldn't matter at all to you as a dentist.
Correct. That is the big caveat, so that informed consent. So if the patient rejects that optimal dental solution, the patient having an understanding that...
Yeah.
That you've given them the option and they've taken maybe a less optimal dental option, but it might be the most optimal solution for them.
Yeah.
But you can only reach that point of finding that sweet optimal spot for both by practicing proper empathy. So this understanding the thoughts, the feelings, and using that to guide your action.
That's a great explanation and a definition for empathy. I think that's very useful. That's great. So we've covered a lot, Colm, and I think all of this stuff is really useful stuff for graduate students and any dentist who's listening. So I hope people are enjoying it. I want to ask you a few things that are more advice for people. Often we're thinking here about students and graduates, but how have you found outside interests to help you in keeping your dentistry and yourself focused in dentistry?
Yeah, this is a theme that comes up in my podcast as well, with my guests as well, the importance of that. It's usually something that I bring up as well, and it's an answer that everybody gives me, some really rich and detailed answer, and everybody emphasizes the importance of having outside interests. And the reason, I suppose, I got to that question in my podcast is because I also see huge value. I think what you said is really important, not just for myself outside of dentistry, but the spillover into myself as a happy practitioner is crucial. So I think you can take that two ways. First of all, you can take that in terms of outside interests, that will flow directly into dentistry, such as my studies in communication skills, conflict resolution. I've done the certificate of advanced dental leadership. I've done a short life coaching course. So I'm always learning, and that's a really key philosophy for me, is to always keep learning. Mm. And the availability of learning online now, particularly, there's no excuse not to learn, even whether it's dentistry or not dentistry. I think we always need to keep learning, and that's key. But also other interests such as sports or hobbies, or even, you know, somebody talked about watching TV, even just doing something passive where our job is so intense, and so we're all parts of our body, both physically and mentally, are active and we're on, and we're looking at tiny little spaces. To sit down in the evening and sit back and be passive and have something entertain us within very small limits, I would argue, is possibly important.
Yeah, definitely.
For me, I find that through sport as well. So I've done martial arts for many years. I find that's just, I think most people who do any kind of sport or hobby say it's a stress release, because once you get into that flow state doing something else, your mind goes away from the troubles of the day, and whether that be the troubles of dentistry, whether that be you've got a family now as well. There's always dramas, always little ups and downs, or just life in general. So doing something outside of all that, family, work, friends, something, you know, that takes you away from all that, I think is hugely important for your mental health. I'd put it in those blunt terms. Again, that mental health benefit flows into your life, but also flows into you being a happier practitioner. And when you open the door at work, you're opening the door with a smile on your face and less of a burden on your shoulders, rather than opening it with the weight, starting your day with the weight of the world on your shoulders.
Yeah, definitely. I could not agree more with all of that. I love that you use the word flow state, because I use that term to describe when I'm riding a bike or a snowboarder or things like that.
Yeah.
It's that feeling, it's like meditation. You can't think of anything else.
Yeah, I've found it even with editing podcasts.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, right in the zone.
Looking at the sound waves on the computer and clicking little bits in and out, I just go into this flow state. That's actually why I enjoy it too.
That's good. I think we're the only ones who understand.
That's an in-joke.
Yeah, definitely. Tell us, with your experience with students, was there anything you saw them... You were mostly working in communication, but we can think broader.
Yeah.
Was there anything you saw them making regular mistakes with, or perhaps as they graduate?
Yeah. So I've worked teaching students in communication skills, but I've also worked as a clinical supervisor at UWA as well. So I've worked on the denture clinic, as I said, for some kind of sin in a past life. And also I've worked on just normal restorative clinics as well. One thing that used to disappoint me a lot was, number one, the amount of fail to attends that students would get, and how blasé the students were about fail to attend.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I used to see this as a real paradox. Students, when they graduate, if you ask 90% of students, will tell you the first thing they want is a good mentor. You're in this really hermetically sealed, safe environment. You've got 3 hours of an appointment.
Yeah.
With a mentor, or maybe two mentors, two clinical supervisors floating around the floor. It's safe. You've got tons of time. It's a learning environment.
It's perfect, really.
It's perfect. And you're just giving up those perfect opportunities. Mm. And I used to get so frustrated when they go, oh, well, reception sent them out an email a week ago, or reception rang them a week ago, and they just shrug their shoulders and walk off. And I'm off to the library now, and they'd walk off.
Mm.
Now, that really bugs me. You're giving away this golden opportunity to learn, that you'll cry for time like this when you're going to practice. So first of all,
that's a good one. Yep.
Be proactive and make sure you avail of all the clinical learning opportunities. We're drilled as, it's no pun intended, we're drilled into academic learning and the need to learn enough to pass exams. And in dentistry, I think it's a given. We're all fairly smart. We are academically smart enough to pass the exams with a bit of study.
Mm.
It's the clinical stuff that that really benefited me and that helped me through, that stopped me from sinking. So when I had failed to attend, I would go and hold the suction for a fifth year and actually learn heaps, because I'd see the fifth year when I was a third year doing a crown prep. And then by the time I got to do a crown prep, I knew what the setup was and I saw it all.
Yep.
But I also saw how they communicated more confidently and how the whole thing just flowed better in terms of the whole process.
Absolutely.
So you absorb all that by hanging around, even if... So number one, be proactive and ensure that you don't have failed to attend. So get on the phone the day before, even if the hospital policies, we ring the patient a week out, that's a load of whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we would all forget appointments a week out, and that's what used to happen at Aqua. It was,
yeah, definitely.
So be proactive, get on the phone, make sure your patient's turning up, make sure if they're not turning up, somebody else is turning up. Yeah. You've got a standby because these are the golden times. And number two, if such a thing happens, because it always happens, they miss the bus, the car breaks down, they forget, and they do fail to attend, stay on the floor, walk around, hold suction for your colleague. So watch them as they're learning, because you'll learn, or follow the clinical supervisor around and watch them go up and interact and help all the other students, because you're going to learn. You're going to learn how to take an impression on the denture clinic. You're going to learn why the student missed the impression three times, and you're going to see the supervisor walk up and get it first time because they've done some little modification to the tray. So you're going to see all these things that are the clinical gold that you won't have otherwise seen. So that used to really frustrate me, and it used to frustrate me how passive they were about that. And I suppose I knew how much that informed me and how much that helped me, that my opportunities in the clinical floor as a student. It's your time to do it safely and do it well. Get good at extractions. Do as many extractions as you can, because that's still a core skill that it's often a make or break of a day, is a
definitely
an extraction gone wrong more than anything else.
Yeah.
And the more you do, I refer back to that sixth sense as well, that feeling of either looking at the x-ray or being 10 minutes in and the thing isn't still moving, you kind of go, stop. Now, I'm referring you before the inevitable crack happens and you're 2 hours bogged down in a surgical.
Something that I like to ask people is, what would you say to yourself? Now, we always cover most of this in the chat, but have a deep think about it. What would you say to yourself just as you graduate that might help you get to where you are now, perhaps with less stress, or perhaps faster or better? What would you teach yourself if you could go back?
I suppose the first thing I'd say about that is that I wouldn't do anything differently. I don't regret the way things worked out.
Yeah.
Because the flip side of the coin on my initial experiences was I got a shed load of clinical experience.
Yeah.
When I walked out of there after 3 years,
You'd be fast.
I'd be fast. I could take teeth out. Yeah. I could do crowns, reasonable root canals, all that stuff. So personally, no regrets. What would I do differently? I'd probably be more proactive in doing CPD and learning, and particularly, I'd say both. I do have a bias towards the communication side, so I would say seek out communication skills courses, but also obviously clinical learning. Self-awareness is really important, so identifying your blind spots either clinically or in communication, and go on and work on those.
Yeah,
I would say, looking back at the time, I probably didn't have the energy to do that, and there probably weren't as many courses around then as there are now. There's just a plethora of CPD now. There's no excuse not to do CPD.
Yeah.
So go back to that. Just probably me, I would have liked to have learned more, done more CPD.
I think that's something, tracking how you're going and, you know, what you're good at or what you're struggling with, and where to place your CPD time is something that's important as well.
Yeah.
We're making a journal around that with Foresight, because we want to help people track, focus that stuff down.
And it's something I did. You just remind me, it's easy to do CPD in the things you like.
Yes.
If you like Crown and Bridge.
Yeah.
You're going to have this unconscious bias to do lots of Crown and Bridge CPD courses. Mm. I would say the opposite. Identify your blind spot, if it's perio or if it's oral med, and go and do your CPD there in your early days.
Yeah.
Because if you like Crown and Bridge, that's going to develop organically yeah. as you go along. And you can do your big CPD later on in that. But
yeah, for sure.
Identify the blind spots and work on that, particularly in your early days, I think is really important.
Be well-rounded as a foundations of general dentistry. It's very important if we have a blind spot, we're not serving our patients particularly well in that area.
And even if you think that you're going to specialise, you're going to be a much better specialist if you've got a much more well-rounded general practice base that you can, your own knowledge is coming from.
Yeah, that's
going to make you a better specialist.
Fantastic advice. I always ask one last question. Sometimes it doubles up a bit, but imagine now everyone who's graduating right now, what would you tell all of them? You can tell them and teach them just one thing that you think would have the biggest impact. What would you teach them?
Go with your own treatment philosophy.
Yeah.
Don't be pushed into doing things that you're not comfortable doing or that ethically you don't like doing or that just in terms of your personality, it just doesn't sit well with you. So I suppose it goes back a little bit to that listen to your heart or your gut, as said the metaphor, pick your metaphor. I've always been a very conservative dentist. I don't like taking enamel off teeth, especially unnecessarily I'll use it unnecessarily in air quotes for things like elective veneers and that. Doesn't sit comfortably with me. And that's not just clinically, that's almost a visceral feeling within me.
Yep.
And if I went into a practice, and in fact, when I interviewed for my current practice, I did go into a high-end practice and did an interview there, and we seemed to get along very well, and they did a lot of crowns and veneers, and it seemed to be a bit of a shoe-in because I had 12 years' experience, and it was a good fit. But I actually didn't take that job. I would have probably earned a lot more money, but that whole side of dentistry, just want to clarify this, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that type of dentistry, it just doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah.
So do listen to yourself and do what feels comfortable for you in terms of, some people are more interventive, some people are more conservative. In terms of being a conservative dentist, I never regret not doing anything that I didn't do, if that makes sense. I never regret being a conservative dentist. It's rarely ever bitten me, say, watching an old ditched amalgam and watching it for another 6 months and watching it for another 6 months. That's rarely ever bitten me as a philosophy in dentistry. Now, there are ways that could, of course, bite me if that ditched amalgam, the patient, went away and didn't come back for 10 years and it turned into a big hole. Or if the patient started drinking lemon juice or something like that and it rapidly decayed. But there's also cons of the more interventive side. If you intervene early in that big amalgam and remove it, you could stir up the pulp and lead to... So there's no right or wrong answer in that, but that's just been my personal philosophy. And as I said, I've never really regretted being a conservative dentist. I probably don't do as much dentistry as other people do in terms of fillings, etc., but it's still, I've got a busy list. And probably, I've thought about this as well, probably my list has developed with those types of patients as well who suit my personality. So not every dentist will suit every patient as well. So don't be alarmed by that as well as a new dentist.
That's a great point in the last one, where not every patient suits you. You're not the dentist for every patient.
Yes.
But also, you have to sleep at night. You have to be comfortable in what you do. And in the end, it is your responsibility, what you choose to do as well. So they're fantastic. Great advice. This whole podcast, I think we've had a lot of stuff we've covered that's been really fantastic. And I genuinely appreciate your time today, Colin, inviting me into your home to do a live podcast. Everyone who's listening really does need to check out your podcast, Communicating Health. You can find it on iTunes and all the other areas. Colm also does a blog, and there's some good information there. There's some mini habits that's worth looking up. I really recommend people check it out. And if you're in WA, you do some speaking, you may see Colm around talking about communication. So thank you again for sharing your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on. And I really am a great admirer of your work too. So thank you, David, for all.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Cheers.
All right, that was Colm Harney talking about communication and tips for new graduates. I think that was great. I hope you enjoyed it. Love to hear your feedback, and it's definitely worth checking out some of his resources. Check out his blog and his podcast, of course, called Communicating Health. So now we've got the Prime Head Start segment, bite-sized anecdotes they didn't teach you in dental school. And today we've got Meg Sharp. Meg is an expert in compliance, in sterilization and infection control. And Meg really shares a lot of information today about audits and how to handle it, how to be prepared for it, how to not have to worry about it. So I hope you enjoy this. Welcome to the Prime Head Start segment, proudly brought to you by Prime Practice. This episode, we're lucky to be joined by Meg Sharp from New Zealand. Meg's a compliance expert with Prime Practice. How are you this morning, Meg?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. And it's a really important topic. I think the word audit makes most of us a little bit anxious. It makes us, even if we're the most prepared dentist in the sterilization and compliance areas, we get anxious. Although these protocols are usually set by the practice management, we're still responsible. So how should we handle an audit?
Great question. And all the points you make are right. Most people ring me and say, oh, we're getting in, you know, oh, I'm losing sleep. And they don't love the word.
No.
Or even if they know that if it's, for example, if I'm auditing a practice and they know me, they know I'm fairly friendly, pretty firm, but fairly friendly. And they're like, oh, we're still scared, Meg. Yeah. So look, whether it's ADA, Dental Board, you know, NHMRC, anyone can essentially audit you. I guess, how do you prepare for that? The best way you can is be confident in the work that you do. So when I started this business unit at Prime, I created a focus, and I called it Get Safe, Be Safe and Stay Safe. And I probably think that would succinctly relate how you could prepare for an audit. First of all, you need to get safe. So you need to make sure that the protocols that are supposed to be met are met. So become familiar with the ADA guidelines. You know, if you read that from start to finish, you'd be in a pretty good place. Know what the NHMRC updates are. So, you know, don't be buried in those kinds of things. Leave that for consultants maybe, but do know what's going on in those documents.
Mm.
Check that the practice has a practice manual and that it's up to date and that people know what's in it, including the products and how they're mixed, etc. Not a whole lot of control you can have over that as a clinician or an associate in a practice, and you're right. It is usually set by the management, but it needs to exist and you should be familiar with it. So that would be how you can get safe. How you be safe, I suppose, is a reference to everyday clinical practice. Check up from the neck up is things, you know, things would spring to mind when I'm certainly auditing the things I don't see nearly, you know, as often as I'd love, is appropriate PPE. So personal protective equipment. Is your mask not just on your face? Is it on and fitted? Is it the appropriate mask for the task? You know, level 1, 2, and 3, be familiar with those things and when you would use a different mask. Eye protection and that of your patients. Are they protected and are you protected? Working with a dental assistant who has the same approach to hand hygiene PPE that you do. Again, a little out of your scope because sometimes you might be sharing DAs and sometimes it can be a little bit out of your, for want of a better word, control.
Yeah, but I think the important point, though, is we are still responsible. So although it may be a little bit out of our control, we need to then appropriately deal with that as well.
And absolutely.
If they're in
totally.
Our room with our, you know, with our patient working, you know, as a team, I think, yeah, we definitely have a little bit of control. So you make a good point.
Absolutely. There. Yeah. Can you do the JD and kind of give them performance-related meetings? Potentially, possibly not, but you're right. You do have control over that. So a dental assistant who is wearing jewellery can't wash it. Both of you, if you need to be able to wash your hands to your elbow a couple of times a day, but potentially all, you know, normal hand washing, but up to the elbow a couple of times. So wearing wrist jewellery, wristwatches, jewellery, acrylic nails, nail polish, long earrings, hair out, you know, those things are a potential risk to A, themselves, but you and your patients. So you're right. So nail it and be clear about what you expect.
And be good with your communication.
Absolutely. Look, communication was going to be the top of my list, and I sort of reluctantly moved it because every time you hear something, someone's like, oh, good communication is key, but it actually is. So having a good relationship with your DA for all kinds of reasons, you need them sitting beside you, working, managing aerosols, being appropriately attired, managing your instruments, wiping as they go, that kind of thing. Becomes critically important to your workflow. So that's about being safe. Another tiny wee thing, do they expose the local anaesthetic cartridges? That's a big thing. They are not always in blister packs as they should be. So be familiar with the things that you need to do to be safe. And then I guess staying safe is around making sure that all those things stay in play, that we've just talked about, but also tidying up the documentation that your critical site items have batch control information on them, and that the BCI is appropriately recorded into the patient's file, and that you know what that means. And also checking, a really big part is checking randomly, once a week, once a month, to bring it up at staff meetings, hopefully they're being had, things around what documentation is happening in the sterilization. Can you produce sterilization monitoring records? Is the machine that is sterilizing your instruments throughout the day, has it been tested for appropriate air removal on a daily or weekly basis? So those are things that can give you, not within your control, but some control over your being ready for an audit. How you handle them? Look, some auditor, I've had experience of not the most pleasant audits, and some people, I hear stories of three people came and one of them sat at the front desk and started going through records. It was not pleasant. I think by and large, I belong to a professional body of people that generally it seemed to be a positive. In fact, we've just published an article called Audit, Horrifying or Helpful. You'd be wanting to think about them as a positive experience. It's almost like a critical gap analysis. What is compliant and fabulous? What is semi or not compliant? And let's do some corrective actions and have an action plan to close those points. So you'd be hoping that it's supposed to be a positive experience. But I take your point, because more people than not ring me and say, I take the worry away. I'm just worried. I have anxiety about this stuff. I just want to know it's being done.
Yeah. So one of the things I guess people can do is reach out to a consultant or someone to help them through that process as well.
Yeah, always.
But it's a good point. I like how you've put that. It's, if you look at it as constructive criticism, and if you are, doing your best to be on top of this stuff, there shouldn't be too much to worry about. But at the same time, if you, get safe, be safe, stay safe. If you do those things you talked about, then an audit should not be too much of a trouble. So
absolutely. And good auditors don't, it's not about a person, it's about a process. That's a really important point to make. So we don't talk about, Susie and operatory one did this, that, or the next thing. It should be about the process. And I guess a final point that I would leave you to think about is, I believe, that a good consultant encourages the practice to be team managed. So it's not about relying on somebody to come and tell you every year. Get a consultant in, absolutely, of course. Get everything in process, and then a big part of staying safe is having a team-managed approach. So staying on top of it and doing your own audit. So buying on Lena, we have all kinds of things that are accessible. You buy an audit tool, you fill it out, you complete it, you get your own action plan. Teaching a man to fish, essentially, is a really big part, I think, of keeping you all safe and yourself safe.
Yeah, and as an associate in a practice, you perhaps can suggest these things and to get these balls rolling, because we're the ones who are often hearing this information when we're still, focused on study and learning, and we may be able to implement them in our practices. So thank you, Meg, for your time.
You're
this
welcome.
Morning. I appreciate it, and there's some great
You're
tips.
You're really welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's everything for this episode. I hope everyone has enjoyed what they've heard. Of course, keep up to date with us on social media at Dental Head Start, Facebook and Instagram. Check out what we're doing with Foresight Dental at Foresight Dental on Instagram and Facebook as well. If you're interested in hearing more about the Foresight Dental Journal, then check out foresightdental.com or on social media. That's something we're excited to talk more about in the future. We hope that's going to help a lot of dental students and graduates out. Thanks to the support from Prime Practice and BOQ Specialists. And of course, thank you for listening and sharing the podcast. Looking forward to the next episode.